The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939. This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
It was a week of gains in most of the major indexes as stocks rallied with the drop in oil prices falling from $123 a barrel last week to Friday's $107 close. Investors are hoping this will bring gasoline and inflation down. The question investors will have to navigate is inflation under control or are more rate hikes ahead of us? If the economy slows down, what will that mean for earnings? Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Up on deck is Craig Johnson. Craig thinks we will have not hit the market lows yet, despite the bounce in stocks this week. The good news is he's sticking to his year-end forecast of $47.75, with tech, healthcare, and energy leading the recovery this fall. One caveat is if oil takes out the $125 level, it could be heading to $150, which means higher gasoline prices and more inflation. And speaking of oil, Dan Steffens from Energy Prospectus joins me later on in the program as Dan discusses why he feels oil prices are heading higher. It's all based on where we stand on oil inventories, which is what leads prices up or down on oil. All of that coming up.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, after falling precipitously or rallying this week, is this a dead cat bounce, a bear market rally, and is more pain in store ahead? Well, let's find out. Joining us on the program is Bullseye Craig Johnson. And Craig, let's begin with what we've seen so far. The markets are down 20 to 30% looking at the major indexes. The Fed is indicating they're not done raising rates. More rate hikes are ahead of us. And we've got oil prices pulling back, but still remaining above $100 a barrel. How can this not impact the economy?
Jim, it ultimately has to. I mean, the Fed does not have our back at this point in time the way they have in the past. And the old rule and adage has always been, don't fight the Fed. And the Fed is going to take care of inflation. It's just going to be painful. We'll probably see unemployment rates move higher. We'll probably see consumers probably getting a little bit more squeezed. Interest rates are probably going to be higher. And it's going to take some time. But the economy is going to be negatively impacted as we look forward. It's just a question, Jim, how much of that is already priced in? That's the real question.
Yeah, because they're saying more rate hikes. It's expected anywhere from 50 to 75 basis points in July, maybe again in September. On top of that, oil prices, refineries are talking about they better convert from gasoline to diesel, or we could have diesel shortages, which means goods disappear off the shelves. So how can this not impact the economy? The thing I really want to focus on is last year, the Fed told us they thought inflation was transitory. This year, they're talking soft landing. I don't know about you, Craig. In my career, I've only seen one soft landing, and that was 94.
That is exactly right. And I think it's going to be very challenging for them to engineer that soft landing at this point in time. But if we take this whole concept of what the Fed is talking about back a little bit further, even before the transitory comments and those kind of things, there was sort of a policy shift by the Fed. They said that they were going to be more reactive than they're going to be proactive. And that sort of commentary from Jerome Powell is leading into exactly what we've been seeing in this market. Now, the Fed is in sort of catch-up mode at this point in time, and they can get there. And the 75 basis point rate hike they just did, the 50 they did before, and now they're probably looking at maybe another 75. At least that's what the market is thinking, is 75 coming up in July and high probabilities of another 75 when you get into September. So it's reactive, Jim, versus proactive. And I think the markets are more accustomed to having the Fed be more proactive.
Let's talk about oil for a minute, because we know the Fed can do nothing about the price of oil other than kill off demand. They can't produce barrels of oil. What's your take on oil here in terms of where it might be heading?
I still think oil has got more room to go higher. As I look at the chart of oil, we just put out our monthly publication, Jim, and as I just look at the setup on the chart for oil, price of oil does not look like it's done. I would not be surprised to see oil prices back at the old highs, and the old highs would sort of put us back into this sort of mid 120-ish level, would not surprise me. And potentially we could, if we break out of that level, Jim, you could be looking at oil prices and, you know, closer to 160, 165 if we break out from here.
The government is talking about rescinding gas taxes for 3 months prior to the midterms. They're releasing 1 million barrels a day from the Strategic Oil Reserve. These are just kind of like band-aids on an essential problem. I mean, they've got to free up more land for drilling. Companies in the shale patch need to get financing. How does that get resolved?
So, you know, this is like talking out of both sides of their head at this point in time, the current administration, because they shut down the pipeline coming from Canada into the U.S., and that would have been gone a significant way in terms of easing some of the strain that we're seeing at this point in time. They've also raised the fees to drill on federal lands and those kind of things. And at this point in time, it's going to take months, if not years, to get caught up. And you're right. The Band-Aid approach that they're taking, take away the tax, just seems to add more debt for our future children, doesn't really seem to help alleviate the issues. And the other problem, we're draining the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Now, if I was anybody outside of the U.S. and I'm watching the current administration, we seem to be putting ourselves into a increasingly more precarious position in terms of energy. And the economy doesn't work, really simplistically, Jim, if we don't have cheap energy and we don't have cheap food. And right now, we have neither. And the administration is trying to do whatever they can to try to protect votes. And they should be not thinking about that. They should be thinking about, how do I work for all the Americans out there?
You know, it's not just the Biden administration, Craig. It goes from Wall Street, from Washington to California. You've got politicians like my own state of California passing these mandates. You can't have gas lawnmowers, gas weed whackers. You're not going to be able to bring diesel trucks into the state in 2030, and you're not going to be able to buy gas cars after 2035. So that's great. But in order to do that, we're going to need copper. We're going to need a transition. So, you know, here they are giving these mandates without really thinking this through. In other words, where's the electricity going to come from to charge your EV?
You know, Jim, that is all 100% spot on correct. And I think there's going to be some changes that are going to get made come the midterm elections. And I think at the midterm elections, I think the voters are going to start to look at things differently. I think they're going to get a much different message from the constituents. It's good to go the direction of clean energy, clean fuel, all these different things. You just need a clear transition period to do it. And you're not going to get it done in the matter of 2 or 3 or 4 years. This is going to take time. And to that point, Jim, the energy problems are so challenging in Europe right now that literally Germany is starting to fire up their coal-fired power plants again.
So if you look at this, I want to talk about nuclear for a minute, because we are real positive on uranium, because they're building 52 new reactors globally. We're only building 2 while we're shutting down 6. I'm not sure where we're going with this. What's your take on uranium? And then I want to talk about base metals that we use for this green economy, copper, lithium, nickel.
So I think at the end of the day, nuclear is a answer to this equation. I think, though, we need to have the nuclear. I think you need to have your solar, your wind. You need to have a combination of different things. But clearly nuclear needs to be stepped up and we need to add some more plants. You know, Jim, it's just very difficult to get it done with the permitting and everything else. The last plant to get done was in, I believe, Georgia on the Savannah River, and it was way over budget. And none of the CEOs and none of the electric utility companies are willing to take on that sort of balance sheet risk to go build a nuclear power plant. It's going to take federal backing and federal mandates to get those sort of nuclear plants built. And right now, none of that exists, and none of that's going to exist under the current administration. Now, in terms of the base metals, copper and some of these things, the chart of copper, Jim, has recently broken down through a big area of support. So it's looking a little cheaper than it was before. I would say that a deeper pullback in copper is probably likely. And I would say you're right in terms of the long-term environment. We need more copper for batteries, et cetera, et cetera. But perhaps Dr. Copper is sort of indicating what the health of the economic outlook looks like in the near term here. And maybe that's why the price has been coming down, because housing is probably going to slow and a lot of other construction related things are going to slow in a higher interest rate environment.
So as you look at this market right now, we've had quite a correction in both the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ. Craig, where do you think we are likely heading here in the short term? In other words, are you still holding to your forecast higher market by year end?
Yes, Jim. So I think what we're ultimately seeing is probably going to get one more, I think, sort of washout in this market, another leg lower. And that leg lower would sort of reach a level around 3,500 that I think is kind of an area where, based upon my technical analysis, would be sort of a measured objective from the peak we had seen in this market in January and that kind of topping formation that has taken place. It would align with how far we're below a 40-week or 200-day moving average, which we're getting down to levels, Jim, that we've only seen eight times since the 1970s. And also with our breath work, it's also suggesting that we're getting to some pretty washout levels. So I think somewhere, if you draw a big red circle around 3,500, I think you're kind of in the zone at that point in time. Now, how do we move higher from here? I think it's going to have to be lower interest rates, the Fed becoming less hawkish, combination of those things. I do think that's going to happen, especially as we get closer to the midterm elections. And if the current administration takes away gas tax for a few months, maybe that's going to push the inflationary pressures up a little bit. But nonetheless, I think that could be viewed as a positive, and along with a pretty big tidal wave of red sweeping through the House and Senate, I think we can lift this market to 47.75 by year end, which is my price objective. And I'm not changing it. And I stand by it, Jim.
Well, we call you bullseye for one reason. You've been pretty accurate so far. So I mean, if you take 3,500 to, let's say, 47.75, Craig, I mean, that is, you're talking about a 36% rise in stock prices from there. That's a big jump.
Yeah. And the other thing too, Jim, is there's still $4 trillion of cash sitting in money market funds. There's dry powder there. When I have conversations with various investors, I can kind of get the sense that their net long exposure is pretty low at this point in time. And therefore, I think when this market starts to work and the breath measures start to improve, I think this market's going to move pretty quickly. I kind of put it to the analogy, Jim, of, well, trying to sit on a beach ball and hold it below the waterline in a pool. Eventually, it's going to slip off and that ball's going to come up, and I think the market's going to rise. And that's exactly where I think we're setting ourselves up for in the second half of this year. But between now and the 4th of July, I wouldn't be surprised if we get that washout toward 3,500. But the big next date to circle on everybody's calendars that's listening is going to be the next CPI report that comes out. And that should be around the 13th of July, where we'll get the June release. And if it's going to be a 9 handle on that particular report, this market is definitely 3,500 or maybe even lower at that point in time. But if we see inflation subsiding a little bit, and it's a little bit better than expectations, that is going to be the catalyst for this market to lift.
So given the nature of the markets, it seems the only group that has really held up well, at least it's above its 200-day moving average, is energy. Whenever you go through these bear markets, a lot of times you see rotational shifts coming out. If you were to set yourself up to invest coming out of this, where would you be looking?
Well, that's a great question. And in this month's Informed Investor publication, we went back and we looked at every sort of major peak to trough cycle going all the way back to 1969, 1970 timeframe. And on a forward 13, 26, 52 week return basis, I would have to say technology, healthcare, consumer cyclicals are the ones that have typically outperformed. Utilities have generally lagged. And in terms of energy itself, energy's had a little bit more of a mixed performance, but it was definitely toward the lower end of the returns. I think the only two that were lower were staples, utilities, and then it was energy. But Jim, I got to tell you, if we're going to continue to see the improving demand for the economy, the tight supply, Russia still not really back in line, I think this is going to be a sustained higher oil price than what I think a lot of people are thinking. Hence, the energy names may not roll over.
So coming out of this, tech, healthcare, consumer cyclicals, and possibly energy, if prices remain elevated, which I agree with you, I think they are. It's not like you can flip a switch with oil. It takes time to get permits. It takes time to get drills. You have to have personnel. All of that costs money and time. It's not something you flip a switch to.
Not to mention, we haven't built a new refinery in this country probably since the 1950s or 60s.
And they're talking about shutting some of those down. Listen, Craig, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you do a lot of great stuff. How could they do so?
Jim, they can send me an email at craig.johnson@psc.com for Piper Sandler Companies.
All right. Well, Craig, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Have yourself a great rest of the summer and come back again.
Thanks, Jim. Have me back anytime. Love to chat with you and all your listeners.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says Contact Us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Prices are still hovering over $100 a barrel. There are a number of reasons why it's there, various explanations. Let's find out why we're at $100 oil and where we might be going in the future. Joining us from Energy Prospectus is Dan Steffens. Dan, I want to open up and let's talk about how we got to $110, almost $120 a barrel in oil. The president is blaming it on Putin and the oil companies, but there are a lot more things going on that have driven the price of oil over $100 a barrel.
Well, the volatility in the oil price has definitely increased since Russia attacked Ukraine. We were definitely headed up. I mean, before the war, we went from, you know, mid-November, oil was below 70. And by the end of February, mid-February, we were at $90 a barrel. And the charts definitely showed we were headed for $100 a barrel. I'd say if it wasn't for the invasion of Ukraine, we'd probably be at $100 instead of $110. But the biggest problem is that during the pandemic, the upstream companies, the guys that explore and find new reserves for us, just slashed their drilling programs, slashed their exploration programs. And as a result, we had about a 1.5-2 year lag of not finding any new replacement for the fields that were being depleted. If we just stopped drilling altogether, the world's production declines by 6, 7, 8 million barrels a day all by itself. And in the U.S., the rate of decline is accelerated because these shale wells come on really strong. They pay out, you know, within months, but they do decline rapidly. After 1 year, they're producing way less than half of what they started out at. So you got to keep finding new reserves. New wells have to be drilled and placed online to offset that decline. And that's why the U.S. production, you know, everybody thought when we got to this year that the production rate would you know, just snap right back to where we were pre-pandemic. And we're still a million barrels a day less on our production than we were back then. So, and part of it is also the fact that that downturn lasted so long that we lost a lot of good people, left the industry, a lot of equipment got shut down, the oil field service companies pulled way back. And so it's going to take time to rebuild back up. And so we now have a big gap between global supply of oil and demand for oil. And, you know, we're draining the strategic petroleum reserve. So when your inventories just keep going down, the price has got to go up eventually. You can't just keep depleting inventories.
Dan, I want to talk about something that you mentioned, especially shale, which is responsible for a lot of the increase in U.S. oil production. But as you mentioned, shale wells, you know, deplete themselves within 2 years, which means if you're a shale driller, you have to keep drilling because the well you drilled 2 years ago is dry, so you have to drill another one. But along those lines is the difficulty the industry is financing to pay for those drills, because Wall Street investment banks don't want to invest in them because of ESG. You have a lot of banks are saying we'll no longer finance the oil industry. It's almost like the energy industry has become a pariah, very much like the tobacco companies did at the turn of the century.
Yeah, and they realize that. So they're all living within cash flow now. All the upstream companies that I follow and that we recommend in our model portfolios, they're all free cash flow positive. They don't need to borrow any money. They're funding all of their growth with operating cash flow now. And they could do it if oil was at 80. So they have a lot of free cash flow now. And they know it. Bankers are your best friends when you don't need them. But when you do need them, they turn away from you. So they realize that, and they need to get their balance sheets in good shape. And they are. The improvement in the balance sheets just in the last year and a half since the end of 2020 is just stunning for me on some of these companies that I follow. Names that people haven't even heard of. These companies are generating $1 billion of operating cash flow now. I mean, a billion. And it's on companies that are not household names. It's not Exxon, Shell, and people like that. It's just the upstream companies that I follow. So it's been quite a turnaround. And the thing about shale wells, they do decline, their production rates decline, but they do produce for quite a long time, 10 or 15 years, but they go from maybe 1,000 or 1,500 barrels a day down to 100 barrels a day, but they're still flowing and they're still making money at 100 barrels a day. But they've paid off three or four times by that at $100 oil.
I'm reading Robelius's book on the great oil fields that were discovered. Many people don't realize that the bulk of our oil comes from about 25 of the world's largest oil fields, like Garwar. But those oil fields were discovered 50, 60, 75 years ago. So, you know, they're depleting now, and that makes it tougher to replace those giant oil fields because we're not finding them anymore.
Oh, yeah. I say many times, if it was not for the tremendous engineering marvel that horizontal drilling is so that we could get oil out of these tight shale plays, I don't know where we'd be right now. There is no way you could have kept production up just from conventional vertical wells. It's this horizontal technology and tremendous advanced fracking techniques and stuff that they have now that have made these shale formations. And there are shale formations all over the world. We just happen to have the best infrastructure, pipelines and stuff that we could immediately go to the Permian, Bakken and stuff and start drilling in these zones that we knew were there to get that oil. So we're in much better shape. If our government would just get the heck out of the way, we'd solve this problem.
I really don't understand, Dan. We've got prices the highest that we've ever seen. The president has gone to Venezuela. Now he wants to go to Saudi Arabia. I'm not really sure the Saudis are capable of producing. You know, they say they can get up to 12 and a half million barrels. They barely can produce 10. So what I find interesting is the reserves are shown in the BP statistical review around 260 billion. They've been that way since what, the 90s?
And yet, they keep producing, but they keep coming back to the same recoverable reserves. It's pretty
They basically say, well, whatever we produce, we find. So right. I'm not really sure the Saudis are capable of producing this extra 2 to 3 million barrels. In other words, I don't think the spare capacity of OPEC is what they say it is. And when is the market going to wake up to that fact? That's when I think you really get a spike in oil.
Well, if you've been following the headlines, they meet every month and they talk about what their quota should be. They have not produced OPEC Plus. Now, OPEC Plus does include Russia, but even before the war, when Russia was fully online, they have not produced up to their quota for seven straight months in a row. And last month, for the month of May, they were 2 million barrels a day below quota. Part of that is there's a civil war, whatever you want to call it, going on in Libya that has took about 1 million barrels a day offline. And then actually Russian sanctions are just now starting to take physical oil off the market because they've been able to sell their oil at a very deep discount. India and China are taking advantage of this situation. I don't know why we don't sanction India, but they're taking advantage of this, but they're paying less than half. I mean, they may be only paying $50 or $60 a barrel for that oil coming out of Russia now. But they're glad to have it because they have energy shortages themselves. But as far as going back to your question, yes, OPEC itself, not counting Russia, is tapped out. The little bit of production, additional production that Saudi Arabia and UAE and maybe one or two others can add a little bit is being offset by the fact that there's declines in 2/3 of the cartel countries are on decline and pretty much terminal decline. And they're suffering the same thing we first talked about. They have underinvested in their fields. And as a result, they can't make their quotas. They've been given additional production increase in quotas, but like 8 or 9 of the countries have not produced close to their quotas for like 10 months.
You know what I don't understand? With oil prices and gasoline prices the highest on record, I mean, this is something that is impacting everybody from the poor, the middle class, and even the wealthy. You know, they have to pay more for their jet fuel and their yachts. But still, the average person, I went to Costco last week for the first time and waited in line for 15 minutes. Because people, you know, they're selling gas at 30, 40 cents cheaper a gallon. I don't understand why the president just doesn't pivot and say, all right, let's get the Keystone Pipeline going. That'd bring in another 1 million barrels out of Canada and just go to the shale companies and grant the permits. And, you know, with that in mind, we could probably drop the price. What he's talking about now is a national gasoline tax holiday. I mean, what's that going to do?
That would help a little bit, maybe. It depends on where you are, especially if the states drop their tax too. But I mean, that could take 40 or 50 cents price per gallon off if they dropped all the federal taxes. But like you said, I mean, you go from like you guys paying $6 to $5.50. Is it really that big of a deal? But we're stuck with high gasoline prices for a while, I'm afraid. And, you know, the latest thing, blaming the refineries for not jacking up their production of gasoline, they're already operating at like maximum capacity. On the last week report, I think EIA reported that the refiners were operating at 94% of operable capacity. Well, they never get to 100. And no matter what, they can't get to 100. The highest I've seen is they occasionally will have a week they're at 96%. And that's because something is always shut down for maintenance. None of these big facilities operate at max capacity all the time. So they're pretty much maxed out now. And the other problem is we don't have enough heavy oil production. And that gets back to the Keystone Pipeline, that we needed heavy Canadian oil. The Keystone Pipeline was going to bring that heavier oil down to our refineries. And you need heavy oil to make diesel. The ultralight oil that's coming out of the shale plays is suitable for gasoline, but it's not suitable for diesel. And our diesel inventories are 23% below normal. They're outside the bottom of the five-year range. And post-pandemic, our demand for diesel just in this country is skyrocketed. I drive back and forth from Houston to Dallas occasionally, and I've never seen truck traffic as heavy as it has been the last two or three trips. And that's because we're trying to debottleneck the supply chain problems, and that's going to take diesel. And I'll tell you what I fear. We are very close to having to ration diesel. And if we have to ration diesel at our truck stops and we shut down or partially shut down the trucking industry, that has tremendous impact on the supply chain issues. And probably what they would do is have to take some industrial users out offline or something. But you just can't shut down our diesel supplier. We're in big trouble.
You know, it was amazing because in April, I took a road trip, drove from here all the way up to Seattle on the I-5. And the thing that really struck me, Dan, I don't think I've seen as many semi-trucks on the road between San Diego and Seattle. I asked myself, why so many trucks? Because, you know, I drive to Arizona. You see trucks on the road, but nothing like what I saw driving to Seattle. And then I thought about it. Well, all the major cities on the West Coast are along the I-5. You have San Diego, you have Los Angeles, San Francisco, all the big cities. And it really struck me that the highway system is the nation's artery, and those diesel trucks are the blood of our commerce. I mean, you think of everything that we get at the store, department stores, grocery stores, it all got there. Even the Amazon trucks that make the delivery, they got there because they're using fuel.
Yeah. About 3 weeks ago, we drove over to Louisiana, and on the way back, there was an accident in the other side of the highway going east. We were going west. And that backup was like 10 or 12 miles because one lane was shut down, and it looked like a 18-wheeler parking lot. And we rely heavily, and this is one of the problems why U.S. oil production can't increase. We have a shortage of steel tubulars. All the upstream companies that I talk to, the guys that are drilling, completing wells, they're worried about having enough casing and tubing to complete these wells. So this supply chain issue is not just baby formula or whatever. It's construction materials that we need in the oil field. So this is all related. I think they're moving as fast as they can. So I don't see a big increase in U.S. production. And the last IEA, the International Energy Agency, that's based in Paris, their forecast of increasing oil supply is heavily weighted to, they expect U.S. oil production to bounce back to where it was pre-pandemic. And I think it's just kind of wishful thinking on their part, because since oil production peaked in November, now oil production always goes down in the first quarter because of weather related issues, but we're only like 200,000 barrels a day higher from 11.6 to 11.6 million barrels a day to 11.8 million barrels a day since November. So, and the active rig count has steadily been increasing, but we're not completing as many wells as we were last year because we were completing all those duck wells last year.
You know, I want to switch the topic and let's talk about another fuel, natural gas. I'm surprised at the level natural gas prices are right now. And normally during the summer, Dan, you usually see lower natural gas prices. They build up the inventory ahead of the winter months. But, you know, we're over $6 here, and we're not even in winter yet.
Oh, yeah. There was no way. Well, we drained because LNG exports really increased because Europe, they went too fast toward the Green New Deal stuff. And wind and solar did not meet their needs. So they had to fire up all their gas-fired power plants, and they ran very short, and they had a cold winter. So demand for U.S. LNG exports, that's liquefied natural gas, ramped way up to capacity. In fact, several months they were exporting more than their design capacity. So there was no way. And then we had a fairly cold first quarter, which is typical of a La Nina winter. And our storage, we ended up 300 billion cubic feet below normal at the end of the winter, and we've not been able to restock storage. In fact, the deficit to the five-year average has expanded. Now, a gas got up to about $9. Now, what happened? There was an explosion down here south of Houston at Freeport, at one of the largest LNG export facilities, the Freeport LNG export facility, that has a design capacity of 2 BCF, 2 billion cubic feet a day. So our total export capacity in the U.S. was 13 BCF a day, and now it's down to 11 because that facility is going to be totally shut down for about 90 days. And it will only be partially back online by the end of the year. And so that's the reason that the gas price pulled back from 9 to 7. I'm looking at right now, we're down like 3 cents today. It's at 692. And still, that's great. The U.S. market was oversupplied because of the shale plays, the shale gas. We had an abundance of cheap gas. So for 14 years, we had more gas supply than gas demand. And now that is flipped. We are now short gas in the U.S., and we are not going, even with the Freeport facility offline, we're going to start the next winter with gas in storage 300 or 400 BCF below the five-year average. That's what the forecasts are now. And if we have a hot summer, which is the forecast, the area of the country that uses the most natural gas for power generation is the southeast quarter. So you take Texas all the way to the East Coast and about halfway up the country, that's the area that chews up the most natural gas for air conditioning, you know, electricity during the summer. And it's been really hot. This is the hottest June on record for Texas since I've lived here. I know that we've been here 28 years and our gas fired power plants are running full speed. So we're chewing up a lot of gas. So I don't see how we can refill storage before winter. And then Europe is really in trouble because they were getting like 30% of their natural gas from Russia. And Russia has actually cut off several companies 100% already. Even without sanctions, they cut off some companies that refused to pay them in rubles.
So given where we are right now, I guess one of the big risks are how high natural gas prices get this winter, and especially how bad it could get for Europe. And the second risk out here is what we're seeing. We looked at diesel fuel inventories. They are well below their five-year average, and that's a real risk the market, I don't think, is thinking about right now.
I see it as a big national security situation. I mean, 23% below normal on a fuel that this country runs on. The U.S. runs on diesel. We may drive cars that burn gasoline, but when you think about it, diesel is all of our farming equipment. It's all of the equipment that drills and completes oil wells is diesel. All those 18-wheelers run on diesel. We're not delivering goods and services with Teslas. We don't have electric trucks yet. So this diesel shortage could become a big deal if we start having to ration. And I've heard that you guys have love truck stops out there.
Not in my area that I'm familiar with.
Yeah, they're really big in, you know, across the whole eastern half of the United States. And they put out a thing that they have several stations, high volume truck stops that are coming close to running out of diesel and jet fuel. I've heard several airports have run out of jet fuel, too. So that's another thing that takes heavy oil. Is, you know, the kerosene or does call it jet fuel. That's an issue. So anyway, I mean, we got some problems to work through. That's for sure.
All right. Well, given this marketplace, what would you be doing, Dan? It seems like the XLE is probably one of the few remaining sectors within the S&P that is above its 200-day moving average. I mean, it's been one heck of a run since the beginning of the year.
Yeah, I like all the upstream companies that are, you know, well funded. You need to look real hard at the balance sheets like we do and make sure they're not relying on bank debt, which really they all know they can't. I mean, some of them do have debt, but they're not desperate for it now. So I tell you, we've got a lot of these companies that are paying outstanding dividends. Man, we have three model portfolios and one of them is the high yield model portfolio. And I think I have 13 companies in there and the average yield is like 9.5%. There's some really, really solid companies that are paying 11, 12% dividend yield. Now, the one thing is when you look at these companies, they're paying what they call a fixed plus variable dividend. So you might bring up Devon or Pioneer's one that pays a big variable dividend and you'll see their dividend yield and go, well, it's only like 3%. That's their fixed dividend, but their variable dividends are 5 or 6 times that. And based on my forecast, they're not going to reduce dividends. They're going to raise dividends going forward. And they're also funding big stock repurchase programs too. So, you know, multi-billion dollar stock repurchase programs. So at the beginning of the year, I have a group I call the Sweet 16. We were up like 80% at pullback last week, but we're still up 50% year to date. And I think that was just a temporary correction or whatever. I think we did get a little bit ahead of itself. So I think we're looking at a solid double on our Sweet 16. But if people are investing for dividend yield, I tell you, there's some outstanding companies that we follow. And they have very, very strong balance sheets funding all their growth with operating cash flow. And they still have a lot of free cash flow to distribute as dividends.
Well, Dan, listen, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work and research you do, tell them how they could do so.
Well, the thing is, just send an email to energyperspectus@gmail.com. And that goes to our member services lady. She's a Sabrina, and she will send you a directions on how to become a member. It's normally $350 a year. I think we're still offering $100 to anybody that says they're a Financial Sense member off the first year. And we get a monthly newsletter. I just published one yesterday, and we have three model portfolios in there, but we're also, we publish, you know, detailed 10, 12 page reports every quarter on all the companies that we follow closely. And we do follow them very, very closely. We have about 350, 400 global members, and a lot of them are geologists and engineers that have been in the industry for a long time. So it's a great networking group. And we have live webinars with CEOs of some of the companies on with us. And so it's just to inform people. I don't manage anybody's money or anything. So this is just a independent research is what we do. So, and I think people are really benefiting from it. Our Sweet 16 was up 134% last year. So we're doing something right over here.
All right. Well, listen, Dan, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Take care, my friend, and have a great rest of the summer.
All right. Thank you.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.